and the case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 87-1965, Marcus C. Zinnerman versus Daryl E. Birch. Mr. Huebner, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case arises under 42 U.S. Code, Section 1983. I'll focus on two issues. First, whether and how the Ingram, Pratt, and Hudson trilogy applies to the deprivation of a liberty interest, that being the allegedly intentional deprivation of an involuntary commitment hearing for a mental patient. And secondly, whether Florida's procedures and remedies are adequate to provide the process due a voluntary mental patient. The 11th Circuit plurality opinion founders on its analysis of Hudson and Pratt. It holds that the respondent, Mr. Birch, who was transferred to Florida State Hospital in a highly disturbed and even psychotic condition, states a Section 1983 claim simply because the petitioners, who are hospital employees, were in a position to provide a hearing. They had a duty to provide one, and therefore it was an actionable abuse of power not to do so. The plurality acknowledged that the petitioners, however, did not comply with state law requiring an involuntary commitment hearing. And Mr. Birch alleges that petitioners knew he was not capable of giving informed consent to admission as a voluntary patient, and that notwithstanding that, they deprived him of the hearing for commitment.
Mr. Huebner, it's not altogether clear to me whether the complaint is that the state failed to comply with procedures for involuntary admissions, or whether the complaint says the voluntary admission procedure violates due process because it doesn't provide a way of determining whether the patient is capable of giving consent. Which do you think we're dealing with?
Well, I understand your uncertainty, and I think we are dealing with the first question. Nevertheless,
not necessarily. I'm not sure.
I intend to address both possibilities in my argument. I do contend that the Florida procedures are adequate and that they do require that when a voluntary patient is admitted, that someone who is qualified to do so should determine whether he is capable of giving consent. Now, supposedly,
does it require a doctor's assessment of the capacity of the person to consent?
Well, a doctor's or someone who meets the statutory definition of a qualified mental health professional. That doesn't necessarily
that
have to be
that is a requirement that we find in Florida law.
I believe that Florida law does require it.
Do you have a citation?
No, I do not. It would be.
You certainly wouldn't find that a burdensome requirement.
No, not at all. I'll come back to that point, but I just wanted to go into the Pratt and Hudson.
Does Florida law also require when somebody comes into a hospital for physical treatment that there be some special procedure to make sure that the person is compos mentis?
I don't know.
Speaking
of just a general hospital.
Yeah, is this a general rule you think the Constitution requires that when a person expresses something and says, this is what I want to do, the state nonetheless cannot take that person at his word without implementing some procedure beforehand.
I know of no requirement under the law.
Might that be a sensible constitutional rule, that prima facie the state is entitled to think that people mean what they say and are competent to say what they mean?
I think so, and unless there is some real reason to doubt it, and then I don't think that any doctor is going to initiate any kind of serious or significant treatment.
Was there reason to doubt it in this case?
Was there a reason to doubt that he could not be a voluntary inpatient?
Was there reason to doubt his competence to give consent to various procedures?
Well, there was reason to doubt his competence because he was a paranoid schizophrenic. He was suffering from hallucinations.
On its face, the Justice Scalia's proposed rule wouldn't apply to this case.
No, but I thought he was talking about a general hospital situation. Here it's different. And we are, by virtue of the fact that we never got past the complaint stage, we pretty much have to accept that he was not able to give his consent as an informed patient. But in refusing to consider Florida's procedures and
amendments... Excuse me, let me pursue. Do we have to accept that it was apparent when he walked up that he was a paranoid schizophrenic? He says, I want to be admitted. Now, anybody who wants to be admitted to a mental institution, you concede, is entitled to have some procedures before he can be admitted. Is that what you have conceded?
Well, he can sign in either. He can come in and apply to be a voluntary patient.
Right.
In which case, some determination should be made that he is capable of giving informed consent, as that term is statutorily defined.
And you think the Constitution requires that for all patients who apply to a state-run mental institution to obtain some treatment? And there's an automatic violation of the Constitution although the person seems totally rational, it's ipso facto a violation of the Constitution if there are no procedures to make sure that this person who wants to be admitted can really give consent.
It's an uncertain judgment. I think
Well, in this case, hadn't the man already been diagnosed at the diagnostic center as having mental problems of a sufficient degree to warrant his treatment in a mental hospital?
That's correct.
So the diagnosis had already been obtained here.
They had made a diagnosis
before there was ever a consent form offered to him.
The record is not clear as to the timing. There was a diagnosis made at the community mental health center where he was initially taken, and during the time he was there, he signed voluntary consents. But obviously his problems had been diagnosed to a certain degree by the time he came to Florida State Hospital. But the allegation here is that the petitioners willfully, though they knew he could not be accepted as a voluntary patient, they did so anyway. They willfully denied him the commitment hearing to which he claims he was entitled. And in doing so, they also violated state law. That is an unforeseeable act when somebody willfully violates the law in this manner. The controlling inquiry in the Hudson case was solely whether the state is in a position to provide for pre-deprivation process and not whether the errant employees are. So you look at it from the perspective of the state. And in Hudson, this court specifically rejected the argument that because an agent can provide pre-deprivation due process, then as a matter of law, as a matter of course, he must do so. The court said that reflects a fundamental misunderstanding of Peratt. And Peratt versus Taylor recognized that a due process deprivation could occur as the result of the failure to follow state procedures. Contrary to this, the plurality opinion says that disregard of state law or procedures can never be unauthorized when the state agents had some authority to act. The petitioners here only had the authority to accept Mr. Birch as a voluntary patient if he qualified to be one. They had no authority to commit him. In Ingram versus Wright, there was a state law that authorized paddling of unruly school students. The court recognized that corporal punishment was an intentional act and that it involved 14th Amendment liberty interests. But yet the court found or recognized no 1983 claim for damages in that case for physical injuries resulting from paddling because state remedies were adequate. We submit if that Ingram is consistent with Pratt and Hudson and vice versa, then the use of excessive and even injurious force in Ingram was not authorized, even though the paddling was. And so it is here. The petitioners disregarded the limits of their authority, and they failed to initiate commitment proceedings when they allegedly knew that Mr. Birch could not give his informed consent. These acts were unforeseeable to the state, and they were certainly, in this particular circumstance, beyond its control. Now, Florida's Mental Health Act. No, it's not. No.
There was, what is it?
There was state action, but mm-hmm. the particular acts were simply beyond the control of the state, as were the acts.
And therefore what?
They were random and unforeseeable to the state within the analysis, the context of the Pratt and Hudson analysis.
And therefore what?
Well, therefore, you look to the adequacy of state remedies and procedures to determine what process is due.
Well, this assumes that it's the involuntary admission procedure that wasn't followed.
Yes.
Well, it assumes two things. One, that they knew that he couldn't be a voluntary patient, and secondly, that they did not take action to voluntarily commit him. Those actions were beyond the control of the state in the sense of Pratt and Hudson, and therefore we look to what procedures and remedies Florida provides to determine if they are adequate.
And what remedies does Florida provide?
Well, there are a number of remedies. I think in terms of damages, there is a right, a statutory cause of action for the breach of any right or privilege due a mental patient. In this case, he was not properly evaluated as a voluntary patient, so he would have a statutory cause of action for that. Further, the Florida case law, the Everett versus Florida Institute of Technology, which is cited in the brief, recognizes a cause of action for false imprisonment when admission procedures are not followed. So he has damage remedies under Florida law. Florida has waived its sovereign immunity in tort, and there's really no contention here from Mr. Birch, as I read his brief, that the damage remedies under Florida law are not adequate. Beyond that, the state provides easy access to circuit court for habeas corpus relief. Virtually anyone can question the detention of a mental patient in circuit court. Virtually anyone has standing, a friend, a relative, a guardian, a representative, an attorney, all may question the detention of a mental patient in circuit court. Habeas corpus proceedings are available to question the denial, the abuse of any procedure for the patient. The voluntary patient obviously is going to have some kind of mental problem he is contending with, and he is protected because on admission, if he has no legal guardian, he is entitled to the appointment of two representatives. One of whom, by statute, is supposed to be a close relative, if such a person is available. These guardians or representatives have a duty to act in the patient's best interests. Both the patient and the guardian or representative are given, must be given, written notice of the patient's right to discharge at the time of the admission and every 6 months thereafter. The voluntary patient may request discharge orally or in writing, and he must be discharged within 3 days.
Mr. Huebner, one of the 11th Circuit's plurality opinion said that, as I understood it, that this case is different from Parrott or Parrott, however one pronounces it, because in this case the state had given these officials the authority to deprive the respondent of his liberty interest or his claimed liberty interest, whereas in Parrott and in Hudson, the state officials there had no state authority to do what they did. How do you answer that?
Well, they did not have such authority. What authority they had was to make this determination if he was qualified to be admitted as a voluntary patient. If they decided he was not, then they had no authority to do anything other than arrange for a commitment hearing. So they had no authority to deprive him of his liberty. They had authority to properly admit him as a voluntary patient. That was all.
But that's kind of certainly contrary to the law of agency, in a sense. Lots of agents have express authority to do only one sort of thing, but yet courts will say they have ostensible authority or apparent authority to do other things beyond that just by reason of the position they hold. Do you think that principle would have any application here?
No, I don't. I don't think they had implied authority, because what they are accused of doing is keeping him there without following proper procedures. Apparently against his will. They certainly had no authority to do that and to specifically act contrary to what the law required.
Well, what if the state were to put out a bulletin to all policemen that you have no authority to detain anyone in violation of his Fourth Amendment rights? And then a policeman goes out and arrests somebody without probable cause and locks him up. Would it be a defense to a 1983 action to say that this officer had no authority to lock the person up if it was in violation of his Fourth Amendment right?
No, it would not be a defense in that case to say that he had no authority to do that. But similarly, in Parrott and Hudson, the agents had no authority to destroy property, which they did, and which they did intentionally. These people had no authority to detain Mr. Birch without following proper procedures. And the question is, I mean, it is looked at from the perspective of the state. What could the state have done to prevent that when a person does not act in compliance with a specific mandate?
Excuse me, I'm not sure what your concession to the Chief Justice was regarding the 1983 action. Were we talking about an action against the city or an action against the individual police officer? You're assuming a city has a policy of no unlawful searches and seizures and is not careless in implementing that policy or whatnot, and an individual officer conducts an unlawful search and seizure, and you think there would nonetheless be a 1983 action against the city or just
I didn't say that.
Just against the officer.
Right.
What are we talking about in this case? An action against the individuals or an action?
We are talking about an action against the individuals.
Just against the individuals.
But they're
for their failure to provide procedures.
That's right.
Maybe you've answered this. I'm not quite clear. But your statement that the action was unauthorized because they didn't follow the right procedure, would it not have been authorized if they had followed the right procedure?
Well, if they had followed the right procedure, they would not have committed him. A court would. Only a court would have authority to involuntarily.
Well, they did have authority to accept voluntary patients, didn't they?
Yes.
If they followed whatever you say, you got the right consents and so forth. So they did have authority to accept the man as a patient and keep him there for a period of time.
If he properly qualified as a voluntary patient.
Isn't that a difference between this case and the ones the Chief Justice suggested to you, that no matter what procedure they followed, they didn't have authority to take his belongings or cause him to slip and fall on the staircase or whatever it is?
Right.
So there is that difference. Between
I think
cases.
So. I'm sorry if I didn't make it clear before.
Well, that gets back to my concern and question that I started with when you began your argument. If the objection is to the inadequacy of the procedure for voluntary admissions, then do you think Peratt applies?
No. But as I understand as I read the complaint, the 11th Circuit opinions and the mm-hmm. brief in here, there's not a challenge from Mr. Birch to the adequacy or inadequacy of Florida's procedures.
Well, it appeared to be challenging it on an as-applied sort of a challenge.
As far as the admission of a patient is concerned, I think that the statutes define who cannot be a voluntary patient, and one must be able to give informed consent to treatment in order to be a voluntary patient. Now, I think this requires, especially in the case where somebody is suffering from some obvious disturbance, that a mental health professional make that determination.
Any citation to any particular Florida requirement that be done.
No, I could point out that the statutes require that anyone who is admitted to a facility be seen for an examination by an MD within, I believe it's 12 or 24 hours. But I think under this chapter, a person has a right to have that made, and if it's not done, he has an action under the statute for the denial of that right. So it would be extremely foolish for somebody not to try to make that determination if they are going to treat him and keep him. That's why I don't think it can be, it is a determination that can be made by a desk clerk, as one of the briefs suggests, because a desk clerk, in the ordinary sense of that word, has no competency whatsoever to determine someone's mental status.
What if this suit hadn't been brought, but the plaintiff resorted to the so-called post-deprivation remedies under Florida law? What would that have been?
An action for damages, probably for probably.
If he brought such an action against the individuals. Wouldn't the individuals have the opportunity to say, well, we know that we didn't give him the procedures that would have been required for an involuntary commitment, but now we want to show you that he would have been committed involuntarily, and we were quite right, and we just were negligent maybe in not giving him these procedures, but... If we'd have given them to him, surely he would have been involuntarily committed.
Well, I think...
In which event there wouldn't be any real damage except maybe a peppercorn for not giving him the procedures at the time.
Well, I think the same might be true under Section 1983 as far as any negligent action on their part is concerned, because this court...
But you think under at least under Florida law, if they wouldn't have been entitled to hold him involuntarily, he could have gotten damages under Florida law.
That's the clear implication of the Everett case, that he had a common law action of false imprisonment, where the people involved in the admission of a patient did not comply with statutory procedures. And,
General, may I ask you one question? Did you finish your answer? I just don't recall. How did you distinguish this case from the Chief Justice's hypothetical involving police officers who make arrests without probable cause? You there, I think, conceded that there would be an action against the officers, even though I suppose there's an adequate state remedy for false arrest in every
police state. Officer had more authority than did the individuals here. They did,
but under his hypothetical, they had no authority to make arrests without probable cause. Just as your people have no authority to accept a patient without either a hearing or valid consent.
There would clearly be a 1983 action based on a violation of the Fourth Amendment for that kind of conduct.
Why isn't there here?
Well,
why is it different?
What they are accused of is depriving him of procedural due process, as distinguished from a specific guarantee of the Bill of Rights. Oh. And that when that is the case, the state is entitled to provide post-deprivation process.
I see. Your distinction is that's a Fourth Amendment case, it's a 14th Amendment case. That's your difference.
Well, that is one difference, but I think the Chief Justice's question was really compared the authority of the police officer to the authority of
the admitting of an agent here.
People. The police officer would have authority to arrest.
Your people have the authority to admit.
As a voluntary patient, if they do what they are supposed to do.
But the same way the police have the authority to arrest if they do what they're supposed to do. I mean, I don't understand that difference. I understand the Fourth Amendment and 14th Amendment difference, but that's the only difference, isn't it? I missed something.
Well,
I don't.
To the extent the police officer deprives somebody of some procedure to which he's entitled, then it would be comparable to the extent that he violates the Fourth Amendment, it would be a different consideration.
Well, isn't it a, what kind of a constitutional violation do you think it is if some psychiatrist walking down the street and he runs into someone he thinks is crazy, so he just has him picked up and taken to the hospital?
Well, there's no state action there.
Well, he happens to be a state employee, and he takes him to a state hospital, and the state hospital holds him. What kind of a violation is that?
Well, there may or may not.
Is there any difference between that and a policeman picking somebody up without probable cause?
Not in a lot. No, I don't see.
Wasn't it a Fourth Amendment violation? The state seizes somebody and takes them off to the asylum and holds them?
You may answer the question.
No, I don't think it. Not in a civil case.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Huber. Mr. Powers?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Parrott v. Taylor clearly does not apply when a pre-deprivation hearing is constitutionally mandated and the state is in a position to provide such a hearing. In this case, there is no dispute that a pre-deprivation hearing was constitutionally mandated. And in fact, there's no dispute really that the state was in a position to provide such a hearing. The state attempts to turn Parrott's...
Do I have to accept that? I mean, and you're saying the court could not decide that there's no necessity for any process when a person voluntarily does something? I couldn't decide the case on that basis because all the parties have conceded that?
I'm not sure.
Because, frankly, I have trouble with it. I mean, I can understand how someone who has wrongly been... whose voluntariness has wrongly been assumed, negligently or whatnot, may have a cause of action in tort or something for negligence in not looking behind what he says. But I have a lot of difficulty in saying that beyond that, there must be provided a procedure, that there's a procedural right when somebody comes in and says, I want to be committed. To do some studies or whatnot to make sure that what he says is what he means. And this
is not, your question doesn't really involve this case, the facts of this case, in the sense that this case is here on the pleadings, and the pleadings, if accepted as true, the allegations, if accepted as true, materially in this respect, in answering your question, are as follows. That if a judgment was made, the judgment that was made, as alleged in paragraph 27, was that he was not competent to give consent. In other words, I allege that, and the complaint alleges that the petitioners knew that he was not competent.
When he walked in.
When he walked in, or after they did their initial evaluation. They did, in fact, make a medical judgment, initially, of his incompetence. And that's not in dispute. And then they made a medical judgment, as the pleading alleges, that he was not competent to consent. Or in the alternative.
Is your complaint simply that the involuntary procedures were not followed?
My complaint...
Is that what it boils down to? That you've alleged everything you have to allege to show that involuntary commitment procedures should have been followed and the state didn't do it? Is that the nub of your complaint?
That's the part of my complaint. Obviously implicated in this appeal are the adequacy of the voluntary admission procedures, which have been put into issue.
Didn't you give up any argument that the voluntary procedures were inadequate?
I don't know that I gave it up as a legal
or
matter.
Didn't allege it?
My complaint initially was founded on the fact, and it was admitted as true, and it's been litigated from the trial court forward on the basis that, again, taking the allegations of paragraph 27, that there was an intentional act here, that there was a judgment, if there was a judgment at all, that he was not competent, and then in spite of that judgment, they intentionally accepted him as a voluntary patient.
So you are not challenging here the voluntary admission procedures as such?
Well, I'm challenging them in the sense that they've been put in issue in this case in the appeal, and they've been specifically put in issue by the petitioners. Interestingly enough, of course, this case was decided prior to Daniels, but interestingly enough, negligence has never been alleged by the petitioners up until now.
But at least you can tell me what your complaint is.
My complaint, I believe, fairly, if fairly read and given liberal construction, would involve both a challenge to the act of intentionally depriving this respondent of a hearing, and also a challenge to the voluntary admission procedures if they're construed by this court to allow a person to be involuntarily committed without any judgment whatsoever concerning his ability to do that, to voluntarily consent.
Well, then you're back to my question. I mean, you're either relying on your paragraph 27 or you aren't. If you're relying on your paragraph 27, then this case does not involve an erroneous voluntary admission. It involves an involuntary commitment. Your claim is that this person was knowingly committed without having given consent.
That's correct. That is the essence of my claim.
And therefore, we don't have to confront the question at all what voluntary commitment procedures have to be adopted by.
I don't believe this court, it's necessary for this court.
And it's possible for me to think that you don't need any voluntary commitment procedures.
It's very possible to decide this case.
What you're saying, in effect, is that on the allegations of this complaint, it denied due process to give this respondent only the voluntary commitment procedures.
Only the involuntary commitment procedures.
I thought they gave him the voluntary commitment procedures.
No, the allegations of the complaint, Your Honor, are that they knew that he was not competent to give consent, and in light of that knowledge, they deprived him of the procedural safeguards to begin with that are embodied in the involuntary commitment procedures.
Well, Mr. Powers, do you think that you may be able, may be right that they didn't give him the procedures necessary for an involuntary commitment? You certainly allege that. But do you think that's the same thing as alleging they weren't entitled to hold him? They certainly didn't give him the procedures, it could be that if they had given them to him, they would have been quite entitled to hold him.
Well, this court is, in a sense, the question misses the point of the case, in that is it necessary to be result-oriented to answer constitutional questions? I think in Logan v. Zimmerman Brush, the court addressed that particular question specifically, saying in Logan's case it wasn't necessary to show that he would have prevailed had he been given
could prevail. It's just a question of what kind of a remedy you're going to get.
I think in this case,
you can prevail. You can certainly, if you're right, they should have given him the involuntary commitment procedures, and they didn't. You're certainly going to prove a deprivation of procedural due process. But that doesn't necessarily determine what the remedy is.
The remedy under federal constitutional law or the remedy under state law?
Well, you're under bringing a 1983 action.
Under constitutional
That's
law.
That's under federal law.
1983, I understand the remedy to be that if I prove a constitutional deprivation, I prove my case.
Well, yeah, deprivation of procedural due process. That's right. But what kind of a remedy does that entitle you to?
It entitles me to damages, as I understand the law.
Because they weren't entitled to hold him at all during this entire period.
Well, that's the way the case would be litigated at trial. I don't know that their entitlement, the entitlement, unfortunately, in this case, and that's the problem with the denial of the procedures, what would have happened to this particular individual, we'll never know. But we do know that had the procedures been followed, that the jurisdiction of the court would have been invoked, that he had been appointed to counsel, that he'd had the right to an independent medical judgment, that the court would have retained jurisdiction, that the court had a lot of options in the treatment. The court could have ordered evaluation for 5 days. The court could have ordered outpatient treatment. The court could have ordered a combination of inpatient, outpatient.
You don't think that these individual defendants would in this 1983 action say, yes, we deprived this person of procedural due process, but we want a hearing now to see if we'd have given him those procedures, we would have been entitled to hold him.
In the federal context, do I think they would ask for such a?
Well, would they be entitled to have it by way of mitigation or as a defense or as going to the remedy? How about Carey against Pifus?
I'm not familiar with the facts in that case. I think the problem is that you're second guessing what a state circuit judge would have done. And without putting out, we can't go back to the situation that existed at the time of the deprivation, and we can't go back and elicit from a circuit judge what he might have done.
Powers, I take it you agree that the involuntary admission procedures are constitutionally adequate if they are followed.
That's been the yes,
you accept
I do.
That.
I accept that.
And you just complain that the state did not follow those procedures in this case.
I did
for
complain.
Involuntary commitment.
I did complain about that.
Mm-hmm. And you think that PRAP does not apply? What are the state remedies available to someone if the state fails to apply those procedures?
In the context of state remedies, the state remedies would be an action for damages for false imprisonment, assault and battery, maybe medical malpractice. It would be subject to 768.28, which is a waiver of sovereign immunity statute.
And why shouldn't Peratt and Hudson indicate that your client is left to whatever remedies and damages are available for what happened?
Of course, the argument here is that Peratt and Hudson do not apply, and therefore adequate state remedies aren't an issue.
Well, is it your position that these acts were authorized or unauthorized by the state of Florida?
Well, in the sense of Logan v. Zimmerman, for instance, I think that the cases are hardly distinguishable. And I think in that sense the acts were authorized. In Logan, as the court knows, the commission of Illinois was entrusted with starting a procedure within 120 days, and they didn't do it. Now, clearly the commission or some lesser employee wasn't authorized to let the statute run. Any more than these particular individuals were authorized to commit this man without a hearing, knowing he wasn't competent to consent.
Well, so far as the state procedures are concerned, you cannot commit somebody without capacity until there's a hearing. And so in that sense, these procedures were unauthorized. In that sense, were they not?
In that strict sense, the acts of the petitioners were contrary to state law
and unauthorized,
as were in essence the acts of the commission in not convening a hearing.
All right, but that's always the sense in which we ask in 1983 litigation whether or not the acts are authorized and unauthorized. We look to see what the state law provides, don't we?
Well, this court, of course, in Logan, the court looked to see what the state law provided, and determined that the state law was defective because
there the state law was just 180 degrees wrong.
It was defective in the sense that it permitted this to happen. It permitted the commission to allow the statute to run, and thereby extinguishing a cause of action. The state law here permits this to happen too by entrusting to these individuals. The state enacts constitutional provisions, entrust the constitutional enforcement of those provisions to these individuals, and these individuals then deprive the respondent of his rights.
Well, that's always the case, but other than insofar as the state law is concerned, these acts were unauthorized, were they not?
Well, I think in following
the
up...
The state statutory procedure just did not contemplate that this should happen.
I keep getting back to the distinction between authorized and contrary to state law. I don't think that they're the same, and I would follow up on Mr. Chief Justice Rehnquist's colloquy concerning agency. I think in this particular case, the state of Florida has entrusted the implementation of Chapter 394 to these agents. And I've in essence sued everybody I could sue who had a part in this. And this action is fairly attributable to the state as the lower court so held. And I don't know how you distinguish then what is the state. I mean, is it if we called these people instead of petitioners, if we called them or mental health professionals, if that's what they are, if we called them the receiving board of Florida State Hospital, would that
doesn't,
make a
doesn't Hudson versus Palmer really require that we make this inquiry? Because it makes a distinction between authorized and unauthorized acts.
I think Parrott, Hudson, and Logan all emphasize the impracticability of the hearing and not necessarily the random and unauthorized nature of an act. Clearly, the cases talk about both, but they talk about, and in the case of Logan, it emphasized that particular language in Parrott, that we're talking about the impracticability of a hearing. And it's my argument that it turns Parrott on itself by going at it through random and unauthorized, i.e., contrary to state law, and thus impractical. That's an illogical assumption. There was nothing impractical about a hearing here. These petitioners had enormous opportunities to provide a hearing. They had 3 days prior to the admission at Florida State Hospital, he had been diagnosed and treated, and the diagnosis and treatment hadn't changed. And they had 149 days after that to invoke the jurisdiction of the court, and they never did it.
There was no showing here. There was not even an attempt to show, I take it, that there was a pattern or practice of these violations.
Well, I've not alleged, for instance...
There was no attempt to show it in this case, was there?
Yes, there was, and the attempt was through the Exhibit G, which I attached to the complaint, through paragraph 27 of the complaint. And Exhibit G is, of course, a letter from the Health and Rehabilitative Services, which runs the hospital, and it involves the results of an internal investigation. And in Exhibit G... And if I may quote, it's found on page 2 of my brief. The hospital itself found that, and I quote, documentation that you, the respondent, were heavily medicated and disoriented on admission was found, and it was concluded that you were probably not competent to be signing legal documents. This matter was discussed at the Human Rights Advocacy Committee for Florida State Hospital meeting on August 4, 1983, and hospital administration was made aware that they were very likely asking medicated clients to make decisions at a time when they were not mentally competent. And there's nothing in the complaint that I've alleged that distinguishes Mr. Birch from anybody else in that situation. It's my allegation, and I think I've fairly pleaded it, by attaching that reliable document versus just an unsupported assertion in my complaint, that this was the practice.
Was there any finding in the district court that there was a pattern or practice?
That wasn't the plurality holding in the district court of the...
Yes, in the district court, was there a finding?
No, in the district court, there wasn't a finding one way or the other. Unfortunately, this case was on the docket at the district court the same time the panel decision in Gilmere was from the 11th Circuit, and, of course, that was vacated en banc, and I believe that the district court's decision... as I think the district court chief judge thought, was compelled by the panel decision, which was an erroneous decision. But it was decided on Parrott, Hudson, and the panel decision in Gilmere, and this particular issue was not
well,
part of its opinion.
Mr. Powers, suppose that we think Parrott applies to deprivations of liberty interests such as this, and that it would apply to an unauthorized individual departure from adequate state commitment procedures. What then is left of your due process claim?
Well, if your question is that these petitioners are an individual departure and not a rogue act, as in Parrott and Hudson, then what's left of my 1983 claim, if the court doesn't recognize the attack on the voluntary procedures, then I would say what's left of my 1983 claim is a substantive due process violation. And, of course, that doesn't answer your question because Parrott doesn't apply to a substantive due process violation. But there is an allegation, if fairly read the complaints in fairness read, that there was a substantive due process violation. And
Mr. Powers, doesn't it torture these facts to make this a due process violation of any sort? It seems to me if your client were shot dead by a policeman with no justification, you wouldn't bring a cause of action for denying him his right to a fair trial. I mean, you'd bring a state action for murder, or possibly a federal action for unlawful seizure. Very strange to characterize it as a due process violation. And you have the same thing here. Your claim is that your client, against his will, according to your paragraph 27, was incarcerated. His bodily integrity was violated. And what you're complaining about is denial of due process? I mean, it seems to me that why is this a due process claim? Everything in the world's a due process claim, then, if this is. Why is it? Well, seems to me you could have brought an action for assault or whatever in treating this person with medicines against his will. The state would have tried to defend by saying the person should have been committed anyway, and you could fight it on that ground, and you'd say, well, he wasn't committed, in fact.
Well, you could
that
fight,
isn't a due process case.
You could fight any case in state court where they've waived sovereign immunity, but Section 1983 liability and the jurisdiction of the federal courts is not dependent on what happens to exist at the state level.
So in the murder case I began with, you think you could bring a suit under 1983 for failure to provide a fair trial?
No, I think I could bring a suit under 1983 for Fourth Amendment violation and for substantive due process violation. A case very like Gilmer v. City of Atlanta.
Well, maybe this is a substantive due process violation only and not a procedural due process violation only.
Well, I think it's both. And I've argued both from the filing of the complaint. I've argued in the trial court and the 11th Circuit that it's both. The 11th Circuit, of course, its plurality opinion decided it on procedural grounds.
May I just make sure I understand your position? If the chief of police orders a policeman to go out and shoot a suspected criminal because he thinks he's guilty of a crime or something like that, you don't think that would be a deprivation of life without due process?
I think it would be a deprivation of life.
Then why did you concede the contrary to Justice Scalia?
Well, I would characterize that particular action the same way the court initially. I would characterize the same way the court in Gilmer did, and that was that there is no amount of procedures that can be taken that would permit that, and that kind of analysis leads you to a substantive due process.
No, there are
analysis.
Procedures by which a state can put a man to death if he's guilty of a crime.
The state can never, without justification, kill a man.
No, I'm assuming they have all the evidence in the world. The man, he's a criminal. They could indict him and all the rest, but they go out and shoot him instead.
Well, then, in that context, I mean, there's
this is the same case. Clearly, why isn't this the same case?
They
have all the facts on this fellow, but they didn't give him the hearing.
There are procedural implications to your fact situation. Clearly, I mean, is it a denial of due process? Is it a denial to a speedy trial? that you have other incorporated rights that of course, come into play when you're dealing with a criminal.
And you'd have, in that case, you do have established procedures by which you indict people and all the rest. You just didn't follow them in this case.
I think the way the decisions are occurring, since Parrott, though, the wise practitioner would be better off alleging a substantive right or an incorporated right than a procedural due process right in the context of that fact hypothetical.
Why? Because it's spontaneous and unpredictable that somebody would do that? Is that the reason?
That's why we're here, because we have some difficulty applying Parrott v. Taylor to various situations, and this is one of them, and yours certainly would be another.
Justice Stevens changed my hypothetical a little from what this case is. This is not a case where the police chief told him go out and kill somebody. It's a case where the police officer, while on duty, took it upon himself to do that contrary to the police chief's policy. That's what we have here, isn't it?
No, we have a hospital administrator who took it upon himself to have his people do it.
In either case, they would be unauthorized, would it not?
if the police chief told his deputy to go out and kill somebody, then if he was the final authority in the matter, I don't see how the state could argue that that was unauthorized.
Why don't you try to get in a couple sentences on your own?
This court has already visited this issue in Monroe v. Pape more than a quarter of a century ago. And the argument, of course, in Monroe v. Pape was exactly the argument that we've got here, and that is the state had laws against unlawful search and seizure. They weren't followed, and the state was arguing that Section 1983 doesn't apply in that situation because it was not authorized by state law. And the court in Monroe said that that's not the nub of the difficulty, so to speak. In fact, to quote the court said, there was no quarrel with the state laws on the books. It was their lack of enforcement that was the nub of the difficulty. And the nub of the difficulty here primarily is the lack of enforcement of Chapter 394. I want to say a few things about the application of the rule in Parrott and Hudson, and I guess Daniels, to liberty interests. There is this court could very well make a principled distinction between a property loss, as was found or as occurred in Parrott and Hudson, and a liberty deprivation, on the basis that a liberty deprivation cannot be restored. It cannot be replaced. You can't give somebody back his liberty as you can his property. You can buy somebody another hobby kit. You can give him the $23.50 back. You can replace his law books. You can replace his papers, or you can pay them for him. But a liberty deprivation is complete. The harm is done upon the deprivation. And on that basis, the court could, in a principled fashion, distinguish Parrott and Hudson and not apply it to liberty.
I thought in Parrott it would have been an adequate remedy if you didn't give him the hobby kit back but gave him money. Wouldn't that have been enough?
Parrott, that would have been enough.
Well, why can't you give money here? The liberty's been deprived, but you can compensate it by money, just as you compensated the loss of the hobby kit by money.
It's very difficult. I think the analysis, obviously, any compensation that's going to be given has to be given in money.
Money's not a hobby kit, and money's not liberty.
There is something greater in value. There's something greater. There's a greater deprivation when you lock somebody up and deprive him of his liberty and introduce into a system mind-altering drugs than when you take away a hobby kit that can easily be replaced with $23.50. Justice O'Connor, in her concurring opinion in Hudson, I believe, if I'm reading the opinion correctly, found a distinction or a possible distinction in referring to the Fifth Amendment's taking clause. And the taking clause, and we were talking about ripeness, and the Hudson case wasn't ripe for adjudication because the Fifth Amendment, incorporated in the 14th Amendment, requires a taking without just compensation. And you can't get to the constitutional question until you get to the question whether or not there's been just compensation. There's nothing in the Constitution that talks about the taking of liberty without just compensation. There is a distinction, which I believe this Court could recognize and not apply the doctrine of Parrott, the rule of Parrott, and Hudson to liberty interest. In closing, I'd like to say that, as I understand the Court's pronouncement since Parrott, this Court is unanimous in its unwillingness to trivialize the Constitution by constitutionalizing common law torts. I think what this case doesn't trivialize the Constitution, but it really epitomizes the struggle between individual rights and the power of government. What trivializes the Constitution is to suggest that in a case such as this, where you're dealing with a massive curtailment of liberty, to remand it back to state court and defer, that the Constitution must defer to state court remedies. That trivializes the Constitution, in my opinion. If there are no further questions, I'll conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. The case is submitted.